Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. As you probably know, Oregon experienced its first oil train derailment on Friday afternoon in the Columbia Gorge near the town of Mosier. This morning, we're going to spend a few minutes talking with Dan Sears, who you just heard on Air Cascadia, who's with Columbia Riverkeeper, about the derailment, the fire, and oil spill into the Columbia River, which has brought home to us a devastating threat of oil trains. So let's see if we got Dan back on the air. Dan, are you there? Okay, so we don't have Dan on yet, so we're going to put Dan on in a few minutes, but I guess we'll just start now. I actually have another guest who was scheduled ahead of, this is the pre-derailment scheduling, but we are going to be talking most of the day today about the planned largest North American coal terminal in the United States, actually in North America. We'll talk a little bit about that and then hopefully get Dan on and we'll interrupt our conversation about the coal terminal and go back to oil trains. On May 24th, over 1,000 people attended the first of three public hearings to discuss the draft environmental impact statement for a proposed coal export terminal at Longview, Washington. If built, the project sited right next to the Columbia River would be the largest coal terminal in North America. At the hearing, coal terminal supporters wore blue while opponents wore red, and the room was overwhelmed by red. This morning, we talk with Roy Staples, one of the leaders fighting the Millennium Bulk Terminal's coal export project, about why this project, which is ardently supported by the Port of Longview and many elected officials, has galvanized so much citizen opposition. Roy, welcome to Locus Focus.
Well, thank you for having me, Barbara. And I really want to thank KBOO for having me on. It's we're in a pocket of Washington that doesn't get a lot of press support, and our local newspaper is very pro-business. So I am excited to be here with you today to be able to tell people what's going on.
I know our signal barely makes it up to Longview. And actually, Dan Sears is on the phone right now. So we're going to take a moment to talk about the derailment on Friday and the consequences. And it really ties quite well into our planned discussion that Roy and I are going to have about the coal trains and the coal terminal. But Dan, are you there?
I am.
Great. Well, let's just talk a little bit about what happened on Friday. I know you just finished a long conversation with Chris Andre, so we'll maybe try not to repeat too many of the things that you said, but just kind of let's do a quick rundown of what happened and where you were at when you found out what happened.
Yeah, and first of all, it's great to hear from you, Roy, too, because, I mean, that train was bound to Longview, Washington, and beyond. It was headed to Tacoma, Washington, and could have really derailed anywhere along the line.
Right.
So I got the word about noon, a little after noon on Friday. I was sitting in a rulemaking hearing about how to prepare the state of Washington for contingency planning around what happens if an oil train derails and spills into the Columbia. Well, that happened while we were sitting in the meeting. And it was a train carrying Bakken crude oil. It was marked 1267 in the placard, and so they didn't know initially whether it was Bakken or some other type of crude. And people leapt into action trying to get kids evacuated from the school right next door, essentially, to the derailment. I'm trying to get people moved away in Mosier, which, if it hadn't been a just dead calm day in Mosier, that fire could have swept into the town and probably wiped out all of Mosier. And so as people started hearing what happened, most people left the area because, you know, we were trying to get the word out that smoke was very toxic that was coming off of the burning Bakken crude oil. What's happening now is really, you know, the conversation is shifting towards how do we prevent these things from ever happening again. And, you know, in Longview, Washington, people stood up to a proposed oil refinery and persuaded their port commission to turn that down, which is just a remarkable victory. And they're looking awfully smart right now for having done that because, you know, these are all facilities, all the terminals, all the refineries that are proposed. They all would be carrying the same type of crude in the same type of rail cars along the same route down the Columbia River where we saw the disaster on Friday.
Well, one of the things that really concerned me last night, I got an email from Columbia Riverkeeper late at night saying that the Union Pacific Railroad has plans to start running trains again along the track where they've just basically taken the oil tanker trains, or cars that had derailed, and just moved them to the side of the tracks. So they're just a few feet from the tracks. And I don't know if it happened, they were, I know that the town of Mosier and particularly the mayor put out a alert basically demanding that the state stop these trains from running and demanding also to Union Pacific. I wondered, have the trains started running and is anybody paying attention to these concerns?
they held a community meeting last night at 7 p.m., and right about as that meeting was closing, people heard train horns blowing and cargo trains began moving along the Union Pacific line just feet from where there's spilled oil, where there are oil tankers still full of oil, oil tank train cars still full of oil lying next to the track, and they're moving cargo now to the Union Pacific line. Union Pacific, as by way of explanation, said, you know, we have a lot of customers relying on us continuing service. You know, what's clear from Union Pacific is they're giving lip service to getting people back in their homes and made whole, but the reality is they spent an enormous amount of their energy getting that rail line back open, and that was priority number one. And now they're recklessly moving trains right next to derailed oil cars, telling everyone it's safe over the objections of the city of Mosier itself. The city's fire chief, you know, was told Union Pacific, I don't think this is safe to move cargo next to derailed oil cars. You know, they're right next to the I mean, you can see images up on ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org and in local media. It's already reporting this, too. It's jaw-dropping. It's recklessness piled on recklessness. And, you know, we're asking people to call the governor's office and have her stand with the city of Mosier and try to help them put a stop to this.
Actually, I called the governor's office as soon as I got the email. I went back and I reread this Oregonian article I'd read maybe an hour earlier, where I saw that this concern was raised. Is there a way for them? I did notice when I was going out to Hood River on Saturday to go to the rally in support of Mosier and to stop the trains, that there were two very, very long trains that were just stopped on the Oregon side of the gorge. One was near Corbett and one was a little bit west of Corbett. And these trains obviously were stopped for quite a while. So I'm seeing, on the one hand, the pressure of Union Pacific wanting to get those trains out of, you know, to where they're going, the destination. But I'm wondering, why do they need to keep any other trains from going that way? And it seems that, isn't there some alternative route that these trains can take? Can't they get them over to the Washington side?
Yeah, I honestly don't know the answer to that. I know that there's been more than a couple trains that have gone through. I've heard the number five trains have gone through since they reopened the line. Apparently, Union Pacific is willing to keep moving cargo trains while the cleanup operation happens right next door, with very volatile Bakken crude oil being handled just feet from the train tracks. The brand new train tracks they put in, you know, it was clearly their first priority was to get the tracks back in, and that's it's beyond objectionable. And I think the fact that Mosier, the city of Mosier, the community of Mosier is being steamrolled in this is a wake up call for all the communities along these rail lines that we need to find ways to shut down this oil train traffic.
Well, if people feel motivated, and I hope you do, you can call Governor Kate Brown at 503-378-4582, and you press 3 to leave a comment, and you can express your concerns about why these trains should be stopped. Have you heard any responses from the governor's office?
You know, we've heard that they actually have been trying to support the city of Mosier. And so I think, I haven't seen any public statement to that effect, though. And so certainly we hope that this is a stepping stone to the governor taking a strong stand against all of these dangerous fossil fuel trains, including the coal ones you're going to talk about with Roy.
Well, Jan, I want to thank you very much for extending your stay here in KBOO this morning. And we should talk about maybe doing another show more about this in July, and we can do a follow-up on what's going on. So thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you, Roy.
Thanks, Dan.
And we've been talking with Dan Sears, who is with Columbia Riverkeeper, and talking about the aftermath of the oil train derailment in Mosier last Friday. And now we're going to go back to talking about coal trains and coal terminals. And again, my guest is Roy Staples, who is an environmental activist in Longview, and a longtime environmental activist. You haven't lived in Longview that long by Northwest standards, right? Only 10 years or something?
Right. I remember coming here, being from California, and I would be candid about it, and I would get the look.
It'd be worse now.
You don't belong here.
Well, it's much worse now if you come from California. It was 10 years
but
ago.
But that was 2005, so yeah. I've been here a while.
Another 20 years, you'll be a native, so it just takes time. Okay. Well, let's talk about your community and why it's being eyed by the coal companies and to be such a major export terminal for coal.
Well, there's two stories about Longview. One is the real story, and the other one is mythology. So let's talk about the mythology because that's first, because that's where people, that's why people know. Okay, there's a fabled person, R.A. Long was his name. He, let's just fast forward and say he got into the lumber business. And things in the market changed, and it was a boom-bust industry, as it still is. And we're in the bust mode right now. And he came to Longview and basically set up shop. And at some point in his career, he identified himself with his workers. And I should say his white workers. Although he had workers of color, he identified with the white workers and proposed that he and his company build a community. And so now we look back on that as, wow, what a great guy. And we have this wonderful community. There's parts of it that's very planned. It's beautiful. It's got a lake, Sacagawea, in the middle of it. And we have events. We have a beautiful square. His company built two beautiful buildings, our library in Longview and the post office. Wait, I'm not sure the post office. What I meant to say was the Monticello Hotel. It's beautiful. And so evidence of R.A. Long is around the town. But the truth is, he was just like any other industrialist, came in with a lot of money, reaped from the natural environment what he wanted, and exploited his workers. They were getting paid, but, you know, he wasn't paying twice or three times as much as everybody else. You know, he was just a regular industrialist. And so that's part of the myth and part of the reality. And now we're looking 100 years later, what is the town now? Is the town this fabled past of industrialism? Or is it actually a town where regular, poor, middle class, and well-off people live? You know, and frankly, since I've been canvassing the grand whole neighborhood, there's a whole lot of middle class folks there.
So let's talk about this coal terminal. And first of all, who is Millennium? Is that a company that has been in Longview for a long time, or are they moving into Longview?
Well, Millennium wants to pick up the mantle of this wonderful industrialist doing good for the community. And let me tell you, they are beating that propaganda over our head with a mallet.
So they're a local company, local terminal?
No, they're an Australian company. Financed by a big coal conglomerate called Arch Coal. And who knows?
Who's going bankrupt.
Who's gone bankrupt. Actually, they dropped their interest to another company. And somebody with more detailed bona fides can explain that to you. But for now, this Australian company, where nobody lives here in town, among the leaders of the community, it wants to build this coal export terminal. And they cut a deal. Hey, if we come in and take the dirtiest piece of property on the port and clean it up a little bit, you know, so we're scratching your back, then you can scratch ours by giving us a good deal. And by the way, we're only going to be doing so-and-so amount of tonnage per year. So really, it's not that big. So I don't recall the original amount of tonnage they claimed. So they got Reynolds aluminum old smelting site, which was a company that operated during the war. We needed aluminum. Yes, so they polluted left and right. They didn't know what they were doing or claimed not to know. But now this is, this is the new century, and we should be cleaning this stuff up the right way. And they've gotten away with, let's say, a minimum cleanup. But it is kind of part of the deal. You know, I came and I bought this piece of crap land, and I'm going to develop it, and I'm going to improve your tax base by millions of dollars. You know, so...
Well, one of the things that I heard frequently at the hearing on May 24th mm-hmm. from the proponents of the terminal is that the unemployment rate in Longview was really high. And I'm maybe making this up, but it seemed like it was like around 20% or more, 20 to 30% is what they were claiming. And there was a lot of the industrialists were pretty much presenting a picture of this town is one of the poorest places in the Northwest, and it needs the jobs, and we care about the environment, but we need jobs. And I kept hearing that. And I kept hearing that from some people, elected officials, Democrats, people I was a little bit surprised to mm-hmm. hear that, because south of the Columbia River, you don't hear Democrats saying that anymore, except for maybe the guy who's represents Clackamas County.
Well, yeah. The Democrats in the Longview area are really unique. One elected official, I don't know whether he was Democrat, said at one point of that hearing, jobs are important, the environment isn't. You know, that's where, you know, these guys listen to themselves in their own echo chamber, and they are convinced that the environment is nothing. You know, we can dump oil in it, you know, over and over. But anyway, I'm getting kind of far afield.
Right.
One thing I wanted to say about Longview, why is Longview an attractive site? And one of the reasons is because people still can be influenced by that mythology that jobs are more important than this newfangled stuff that some of you might be interested in, but we're going to call tree huggers, so that you can see just how absurd those people are. But we're in fact offering jobs, jobs, jobs. And they repeat it just like any other propagandist would. And they claim that's going to be thousands of jobs.
How many jobs is it really going to be?
135, maybe.
And are they permanent jobs, or are these just temporary jobs?
Those would be permanent after the installation of everything.
And that would be, there'd be more jobs when they're doing the construction, I'm assuming.
Yeah, that's where the 1,000 comes in. And, you know, usually in a realistic sense, the thousands of jobs go to lots of people that have been building these things before. So they're not likely to be from the local area. And the permanent jobs are definitely going to go mostly to people that have done this before, you know. So granted, maybe there are some jobs, maybe 30 to 50. But let's keep it in the big perspective. The Port of Longview, which has an equivalent amount of acreage in that area, so in the area of the river, employs several hundred. And there is no comparison. And for another comparison, one could say... Reynolds' other site in Troutdale in Oregon, which is now a FedEx distribution center, does employ, I think, 700 or more people.
And there's no coal dust.
And there's no coal dust, you know. And we need to get to coal dust at some point in DIS.
Actually, let's get to coal dust right now, because I found it interesting. The opponents talk about coal dust, and actually it's, some of that dust is large particles, actually, and little chips of coal that fly off the trains as they're going through the gorge and coming up to Longview and everywhere else they travel around the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting to me to hear all the proponents of the terminal talking about how there is no coal dust. And
right.
One guy, he was one of your elected officials, said that he went to some coal town, I guess, in southwestern Virginia or West Virginia, and he expected it to be dirty and grimy and covered with black. And it was as clean as Longview, and it was just beautiful, and there's no dust and no dirt from coal. So let's kind of take apart those two contradictory realities.
Well, if you look at the DEIS,
and what does the DEIS mean?
The DEIS, the draft environmental impact statement. The meeting on the 24th was for the people in power to introduce that and get comments on it, and then sometime next year or the year after there'll be a final EIS. It's something done with the collaboration of Millennium themselves. So they pay the person to do it. And the Department of Ecology, which is kind of like an oversight group.
They're kind of like Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality,
right,
basically.
Right, right. They ask for edits, and they say, well, this is actually inaccurate. You have to fix it. But they don't have, you know, veto power. They don't have the kind of thing where, no, your biology is just crazy here. So when this thing gets published, yeah, it's a draft, but it is a public document, and it's an intimidating public document, and people feel like it's a fait accompli. I mean, it's already done. I can't criticize it. Unfortunately, this DEIS really must be criticized because one of the most important things relates to coal dust. They say because coal dust is not regulated in the United States by the federal government, we can't really say anything about it. And that's really the biggest lie, in Goebbels' terms, you know, the biggest lie that they're proposing. And during that hearing, you heard them say it over and over and over again. That coal, you know, the industrialist there, Mr. Sprague or Sprague, he repeated it himself. Oh, look, the DEIS confirms our beliefs that coal dust is not a factor.
Well, I'm going to back up. Why is coal dust not regulated in the United States?
I have no idea. You know, it's kind of why diesel trucks have their exhaust pipes going up into the air, since diesel was, you know, since exhaust was regulated down below, they kicked their exhaust up higher in the air so they couldn't get regulated. So it's kind of like it's a shell game. You know, if we believe that coal dust doesn't exist, then we're going to get this DEIS approved. And the biggest thing that's going to affect all these people is going to be a non-thing.
So is there a way to get to get the coal dust into the DEIS?
Well, there's a gentleman named Dr. Jaffe who did a report on coal dust, and I haven't read it myself, unfortunately, but he did find that, you know, coal dust actually exists and it comes off of trains, you know. There are many, many real live circumstances where you see coal dust exist around coal export terminals. There was a report just last month about coal dust flying off the export terminals in Montgomery, Alabama, and getting into downtown and downtown Montgomery. And it was a great report and great timing, I got to say, because it happened just a week or two before May 24th. So it's a very real thing, but the DEIS did not base its findings on reality. It based its findings on this model that they created. And it's a very sophisticated model and has all these big terms and big words and may lend itself to credence by other people or credibility, but those who have experience in modeling can see right through it. Unfortunately, how are you going to take it apart in hearings like this, where you're only allowed to talk for 2 minutes and you can't show your displeasure, you can't show emotion? I'm talking about the 24th, and frankly, you only have 2 minutes, you know? They reduced it to 2 minutes so that they'd accommodate the vast majority of people, but 2 minutes is so little time. you can't get into anything substantive, you know.
Well, I remember at a hearing I went to that the DEQ, which is the Oregon's version of the Department of Ecology, and it was around the Morrow coal terminal that was proposed, and which is dead now.
Right.
And people brought bags of the coal chunks because this, I mean, it's like coal dust. There is dust, but there's also these big chunks that I've seen. And they brought tons and tons, but they brought lots of bags of these chunks of coal that were found along the railroad tracks in Washington and in Oregon, mainly in Washington, and actually right along where She Who Watches is a great place to pick up coal chunks. And they just deposited them. It was part of their statements is that they brought the bags. And I think people, some people on the 24th had bags of coal, as I recall.
Oh, wow,
but it seems to me to be a very effective way. You say it doesn't exist. Yeah, we just picked this up along the tracks last week.
Well, that same bunch of coal that I think Columbia River Keeper folks and others picked up is something that we, LCSC, the group that I'm part of, use in our tabling at events. And we originally put it in this large jar, and it was a small amount, so it wasn't explosive, but it was very, it was a great teaching tool because at first it was chunks, and over the weeks it broke down, and by the time I got to use it at, it wasn't Earth Day, it was the Cowlitz Fair, it was virtually powder, and all I had to do was shake it once, unscrew the cap, and out came this miasmic dust. You know, coal dust is real, folks. And if you know those coal trains go back and forth, they're only going like 5 miles an hour, but they go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. That is breaking up the coal, and it's exuding this stuff. And frankly, the more toxic stuff is the stuff you don't see, the arsenic and mercury. So coal dust is real. Don't let the DEIS fool you. It is very, very real.
Well, let's talk about this terminal and why it's of such concern. How many coal trains would be being brought through because of the terminal that aren't coming? There already are coal trains that come through Oregon. Obviously, that's where Columbia River Keeper gets their coal dust from. But how would this exacerbate the situation?
Well, right now we have a very small coal plant in Centralia. And I'm sure coal goes further, but I'm not familiar with where it's being burned or anything. But what this would do, what this coal export terminal would do, is export 44 million tons of coal every year. Now, if you want to know how big that is, if you know the Lewis and Clark Bridge, it's the amount of coal would tower way over that bridge. And you know that bridge is very tall. So it's a huge amount of coal, and it would require 8 trains, a mile and a half long, in and out of the coal terminal every day. Every day. And this is just totally absurd. Anybody who drives down I-5 from Longview to Portland or back the other way can see that the trains are sitting in the middle of the highway frequently. And they're going so slow. Why? Because they're on antiquated tracks. These tracks date from, 100 years ago? They haven't increased the safety of them. It's not a safe system like a monorail that goes deep into the train itself, and it, you know, you can't derail from that. No, this is an ancient facility that had no need to be worried about emergencies because they were transporting mostly grain and dry goods that were not flammable.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Roy Staples. He's one of the leaders of opposition to the largest coal terminal proposed for North America in Longview. And we're talking this morning about why there's so much opposition to this terminal and what you can do. Dan, we'll get to what you can do about this because there's a deadline coming up actually next Monday, I believe, as far as hearing testimony. Well, let's talk about trains for a moment because I think we had a really dire lesson Friday on how unsafe these tracks and these trains are. And it's, I'm not sure, I mean, it may be not quite as bad to have coal trains derail, but it's than to have oil trains derail. However, coal also can set itself on fire. And right. That's my understanding why they don't cover it, because if you cover it, it gets too hot and then it has spontaneous combustion.
Right.
So let's talk about some of the dangers. And I'm really interested in hearing is, were there any lessons learned, do you think, in Longview from what happened in Mosier on Friday?
Well, what happens in a community with community groups, it's slow. And it's based on what media they're exposed to. And that's one of the reasons why I really want to thank KBOO for having me, because we just don't get a chance to say what we need to say. You know, why is OPB obsessed with what's happening in the Mulyar National Wildlife Refuge when there's a big, important change that's happening right here in Longview and the surrounding areas? Fossil fuel stuff is being proposed left and right.
And actually up and down the whole I-5 corridor.
Right.
And out to the coast.
The coal companies are in a fit because they can't get rid of the coal that they have, and they can't dig more up, and they can't do what they've been doing for hundreds of years. And, you know, we have to convince them as people who live and breathe, all right, and have a right to live and have a right to stay where we're living and not get kicked out because some company got this weird permit that allows them to do all this horrible stuff right next to us. So we got to get up and say, leave this stuff in the ground. It's done. We're over that. We're a better world now. We're a better country. We don't burn it for a reason in this country because people don't want it and it's toxic. Let's not do that to other people. Let's not condemn the people of China and other countries that unfortunately still burn coal to breathing all that stuff.
Well, yeah, I'm actually thinking about Josh Fox's latest film, and one of the stronger parts of the film was the scenes in Beijing where you can't see this. You can't see anything. I mean, it's the worst pollution I've ever seen. I mean, it was only in a movie, fortunately for me. But and also the almost matter-of-factness of which people take this noxious atmosphere that you can't breathe. You live in buildings where you can't open the windows. People wear face masks when they go out. So do you think that people in Longview who are supporting this coal terminal have any sense that this is the end result of this coal that would get exported to China?
People in Longview want jobs. So you're right. The point you made before about there not being a lot of employment, yes, there's some people who really want those kind of jobs. However, what I found, because I've canvassed the entire community and our group has been expanding with help from other organizations and reaching the community that way, because our media doesn't, we found that there's a lot of middle-class people moving in with families, with hopes and dreams of the future. If they're not moving to Vancouver, they're moving to Longview and areas around there. We can't stop the fact that our area of Southern Washington is growing, and it's not growing into a pocket of Neanderthal workers who would work for anything. Sorry, that myth is old. It's dead. These people have concerns about the environment just like any other town. You wouldn't put a coal export terminal in Monterey, California, and Longview doesn't deserve it either. We're closer to that comparison than the myth that they want to propose.
Now, why is it that a coal terminal would be such a difficult neighbor?
Okay. It's a very interesting part of the DEIS. Really speaks to it, but it doesn't have the neon lights flashing. So the Department of Ecology found that the amount of increased pollution by the export terminal would still fit within our standards, state standards for acceptable levels of pollution. And the two reasons are, number one, over the decades, our pollution levels have decreased because people have been fighting for that, right? And number two, it's just happenstance. And who knows, maybe some of those numbers were a little edited. But even though they're within the standards and they'd be acceptable, what that means is that no other polluter would be accepted into this area. So let's look forward. Let's think about the future and picture a town where a coal export terminal is now the dominant industry, because you can't avoid it. You'll see this thing. And what will happen? Number one, it will become a one-industry town, a company town, which is what the industrialists really want. And number two, no other place would want to bring their business. You don't want to say, oh, we have organic strawberries. We grow them in Longview, you know, the town with the coal export terminal. No, it's not going to ride, you know. And so it's like a catch-22. If we bring this coal export terminal in, it is going to be going to pollute. It's going to raise our asthma rates. It's going to hurt everybody. And it's going to destroy our property values because, frankly, you know, you're in a coal town. And it's not, it's going to doom our future to just them. And that's even pretending that there is a future for coal anywhere in the world.
Have you ever actually spent much time in a coal town?
No, I was in Lynchburg, Virginia for a while. I don't know how close that is.
Yeah.
But
actually, well, I've never spent much time in it, but I have driven through a coal town one time. It's I can't remember the town now, but it's about 10 miles out of Paonia, Colorado. Hmm. And Paonia, Colorado is in this beautiful valley up in the mountains, and it's famous for its orchards. And it turns out it's where all the bankers and wealthy people built their houses who made money off of the coal mines that were just 10 miles up the road. And when I left Paonia, I drove through that coal town. And it was like driving through something in How Green Is My Valley, that movie. It was a classic coal town. And the contrast between that and Paonia was just so stark. Because Paonia, I almost thought about moving there, except it's too far inland. But it's beautiful, and it's a small town with a great, vibrant culture, and it has a great community radio station. But this coal town made me think that this is the other side.
Right.
And you're not going to have Paonia without that coal. Or
right.
you could, but you have to like think of a whole different kind of relationship.
Right.
So I'm wondering if that's a story that can be brought to Longview about what it really is like to be in a coal town.
Well, I think that's part of the effectiveness that our opposition has. There isn't a lot of experience with coal. And people, you know, the Pacific Northwest is not known, oh, that's a coal export area.
Oh, we have a lot of coal here.
Yeah, we have a lot of coal.
A lot of coal mines in Oregon.
Yeah, you know, we just burn that stuff. We love it. It's not Kentucky, all right? It's not West Virginia.
Or Colorado, for that matter, or Wyoming.
Right. Yeah. So when people say, we're going to be selling clean coal, people kind of, they don't question it. And that's truly unfortunate, you know, because our public officials don't want to question it when this big industrialist says it, and then we get a person who wants to run for office, and frankly, sad to say that some of them are Democrat, and they say, I'm 100% in support of clean coal being exported to China. It's kind of hard for a Department of Ecology person to say, coal ain't clean, folks, you know. It's the stuff called coal dust. So,
not only that, coal is not clean to burn. And then there's also all the chemicals, the noxious chemicals, like you mentioned, the mercury and arsenic, I guess,
right.
and some other really horrible things. Well, we are almost out of time, but I want to let people know, what can they do to stop the Millennial Bulk Terminal coal export project from actually happening?
Well, I've been involved with a group of, well, they would call themselves a citizens group. It's called Landowners and Citizens for a Safe Community, and they got their name from opposing a LNG terminal, liquid natural gas, years ago, because they wanted to show that we ain't just renters against this. We're people that own property, you know. But it's the same group, kept the name. What can we do? But they're fighting against this coal export terminal. And you can get involved by, I guess you can do a search on Longview, Washington.
Actually, if you go to the Locus Focus website, we have a link.
Okay, great.
And there's a link that takes you, I think, actually to the Columbia River Keeper page about Millennium Project. And you can sign up to make your statement, your testimony.
So we work closely with Columbia River Keeper. They've been a really key helper in our group. Also Sierra Club and Greenpeace. Sometimes when we have really difficult things to do, Greenpeace will help us with a bunch of young people.
They'll hang from bridges and things like that.
Well, no, they don't do that in our community, but who knows? But they help canvas our community, and we are indebted to them for that. There's Columbia River Keeper is our help us with research, helped us many times in this fight. And so a great way to contact us and to get involved is to contact them.
Right. So just go to ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org. And actually, if you look at the projects they have, and there'll be one about coal terminals, and it'll actually take to a link to your organization, I believe.
Great, great.
So
we're hopefully building a website, and, you know, we're busy people. I'm a working person. I work full-time hours. I don't get paid full-time job, but a lot of us are very busy. We don't have time for that, but Columbia River Keeper has really helped us.
And yeah, and we are just about out of time. Anyway,
thank you very much.
Thank you,
really
Roy. We've been talking with Roy Staples, who is one of the leaders fighting the Millennium Bulk Terminals Coal Export Project. And again, for more information, go to ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org and look for the section on coal. So you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio. And next week, I'm be taking the week off, but we'll be broadcasting a show about Beaver, featuring writer Francis Backhouse, who's author of Once They Were Hats. I'll be back in 2 weeks, and my guest will be Bob Salinger. We'll be talking about the impending slaughter of cormorants in the name of protecting salmon. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Kathy McToy. Thanks for listening.